Today, I'm bringing to you a conversation that my colleague, Jeff Snyder, and I had with Richard Davies and Jim Meggs, hosts of How Do We Fix It? A wonderful podcast in search of constructive and practical ideas to address the many problems that plague our age. I recommend subscribing to it. Jeff and I had a fantastic time talking to Richard and Jim about free speech, academic freedom, and campus politics. We discussed DEI Inc., what the term means, and why we think it's useful. And we argued that an ascendant discourse of harm is at the heart of today's threats to campus free expression, from the chilling effects of many DEI initiatives to the even chillier effects of anti-CRT legislation like Florida's Stop Woke Act. This conversation aired last week on How Do We Fix It? As the episode titled, Diversity is Great, DEI Isn't.
Diversity, equity, inclusion. Sounds like a good thing in an incredibly diverse country such as ours, especially when we're teaching young people at American colleges and universities. Who could be opposed to that?
Well, me, for one. The DEI industry, or DEI Inc., as our guests today call it, has totally gone off the rails. When you look at how it's operating on college campuses and so many other institutions, it's having a really pernicious effect. And we're going to get into that with today's show.
Professors Amna Khalid and Jeff Snyder are our guests.
The fact that we can have diversity trainings dealing with this wonderful, messy, multifaceted, multi-perspectival thing called diversity in the United States, and you come out of a diversity training bored and possibly upset, that's crazy.
So yes, we are extremely pro-diversity, but I think we do need to talk about what diversity is.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Most large American corporations, as well as colleges and universities, have diversity training sessions.
It's a large and lucrative business for many of the people that are involved with it. But there is no reliable evidence that these sessions really work. And on many campuses and workplaces, DEI could be making things a lot worse. Moreover, imposing an ideological litmus test, which these programs implicitly and sometimes explicitly do, ultimately encourages cynicism and dishonesty at places of learning.
So let's hear more from Amna Khalid and Jeff Snyder. Amna is a history professor at Carleton College in Minnesota. She specializes in modern South Asian history, the history of medicine, and the global history of free expression. Growing up under a series of military dictatorships in Pakistan, Amna has a strong interest in issues relating to free speech.
Jeff Snyder is also a professor at Carleton, a historian of education who studies questions of race, national identity, and the purpose of public education in a diverse democratic society. He's the author of Making Black History, The Color Line, Culture, and Race in the Age of Jim Crow. Here's our interview with them both.
Amna and Jeff, welcome to How Do We Fix It?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Amna, I'd like to start with you and a quote from the great African-American writer and thinker Ralph Ellison. Back in the 1960s, he wrote that the diversity of American life is often painful, frequently burdensome, and always a source of conflict. But in it lies our fate and our hope. Why do you agree? Why do you think that's an important statement?
I think it's an incredibly important statement because it really captures what diversity is all about. You know, we talk about diversity all the time, especially on higher ed campuses, this conversation about DEI, inclusion, we want to be welcoming to everyone. But diversity doesn't happen in a Disneyland kind of fashion. It actually happens when we talk across differences, when we actually confront divergent viewpoints, and that involves some degree of conflict. There is no way to live in a pluralistic society when we assume that we're just all going to be happy, clappy, and it's all going to be smooth.
In this goal of achieving diversity, you both have used the term DEI Inc. in your writings. Jeff, what do you mean by that?
Well, we use the term DEI Inc. to try and distinguish between what we see as the vital significance of the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the way that those values have been articulated by college bureaucracies. And the logic with DEI Inc. is that students are consumers, right? Education is a product, and diversity is this thing that needs to be managed from the top down. So in many ways, it's a incursion of a corporate model of management into the landscape of higher ed. Also critical to the DEI Inc. logic is the notion that students are fragile and that they can be harmed by exposure to uncomfortable or distressing ideas.
And what about the lingo of DEI Inc., the wooden and sometimes hard to understand words that frame this business model?
It's phrases like inclusive excellence, the intent impact gap, microaggressions, trigger warnings. There's a whole kind of lingo and discourse that has grown up around DEI Inc.
There's nothing wrong, though, is there, with trying to have greater diversity?
I couldn't agree more. I think diversity is an incredibly important value. It's especially important for higher education because the quality of education improves. It's not just diversity in leadership. We need diversity in our faculty. We need diversity in our students. But I think there is a conversation to be had about what we really mean by diversity and what the value of diversity is. I think we've embraced it uncritically. What we're doing is we just want people to look different, but we're not harnessing the real power of diversity, which is bringing different viewpoints and different ideas together, which often, but not always, come from people who look different, in great part because we've had different kinds of experiences growing up. So yes, we are extremely pro-diversity, but I think we do need to talk about what diversity is. The other thing I'd like to say, and I'll shut up after this because I have a tendency to talk too much, is that diversity is very context dependent. What does it mean in Hillsdale College will be very different from what it means at Berkeley.
One of the things that you focused on is this idea that diversity training is the wrong way to approach diversity. In fact, in some cases, maybe it actually undermines the kind of honest diversity you're talking about, the genuine diversity of viewpoints. Tell us a little bit more about that.
DEI Inc. and diversity training, above all else, is a form of etiquette. And so in one of my classes, I asked my students whether they had noticed the language of DEI Inc., concepts like microaggressions, were having any kind of chilling effect on the campus climate. And there was a pregnant pause. And then one student raised his hand and he said, I've seen this with my own personal experience. He said, I'm from Morocco. I'm from Marrakesh. I came to Carleton eager to discuss my background, my culture. He was very proud of where he came from. He held very dear his own cultural traditions and heritage. And he said, people won't ask me where I'm from because that was the number one item on a list of microaggressions that we were given on a handout during New Student Week. That's amazing to me because, well, first of all, it reduces what is this wonderful, complex, magical, transformative power of diversity to a checklist, right? Thou shall not ask where are you from. Can it be a microaggression? Of course it can, right? Can it be a friendly way to try and get to know somebody? Of course it can. And so I was stunned and disheartened by his comment. And it really struck me that colleges and universities have created this very strange environment where you have more ethno-racial diversity, more international diversity, more regional diversity than you've ever had before in the history of higher education. But students aren't able to capitalize on it because many of them are afraid to talk to their peers, the sense of, I don't want to offend somebody. And so I think that's the DEI trap that Amna and I are describing that cuts against the real power of diversity to be transformative.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned the phrase diversity statements. What are they?
Well, a diversity statement is usually, when we talk about them in the context of higher education, what we're seeing is that there is now a requirement when hiring faculty and also for their promotion. So not just for hiring, but for tenure, that you have to write, in addition to a teaching statement and a research statement, which we do write, which is our work, we also have to now write a diversity statement, which is pretty much an ideological kind of litmus test. What counts as diversity is determined by the people who are going to read it, but it's not really determined by the people who are going to read it because DEI already means a particular thing on college campuses these days. So it is a sort of a political litmus test, and it is a way of weeding out people who don't subscribe to the dominant DEI Inc. model.
What might be an example of that?
A statement like, I believe that all students should be treated as individuals. And there are documented instances on diversity scoring metrics and rubrics where that kind of statement is marked down.
You mean that's marked as a negative?
Yes, yes. And so that would show you kind of one of the bedrock assumptions that's part of DEI Inc., which is not just a skepticism, but a hostility toward colorblindness. And there are different forms of colorblindness. There are certainly what I would say is a regressive or reactionary form of colorblindness that doesn't want to acknowledge systemic racism and historical injustices. But I think there are many people who would say that we're still living through a period where we can recognize the profound effects of historical racism and discrimination. And yet I strive to treat all students as individuals. That strikes me as a legitimate position, especially for people of all ethno-racial backgrounds who are religious. That colorblindness often ties deeply into a strong religious faith.
Another example might be, let's say that I am advising the College Republicans group as a faculty advisor. Now, in my tenure and promotion, if I put that down in my diversity statement, even though Republicans might be a minority on campus, that is not going to count in my favor because it doesn't fit the understanding of what diversity is according to DEI Inc.
I want to promote something you've both done, which is this short YouTube video that makes a crucial point about the difference between training and education, because DEI programs are training sessions. They are not educational sessions.
Here are some things training is good for: customer service, Excel, and CPR. Here are some things it's not good for: diversity, equity, and inclusion.
At a time when trainings are proliferating across institutions of higher learning, people could be forgiven for confusing training with education. But they are vastly different and should be seen as such.
A short clip there from Jeff and Amna's animated video, which is only 6 minutes long, and it's on YouTube. We have a link to it on our website for this show. So what does separate training from education?
Yeah, I think the fundamental difference between training and education is that training would tell you what to think, and education would teach you how to think. If you look at the way that colleges and universities have done diversity training, rather than taking on the complex business of trying to understand race, racism, historical injustice as a series of open questions, DEI training regards highly complex, highly contested visions of the social world and of public policies as closed.
So let's take an example from the classroom.
If you were taking on the topic of affirmative action, one would have a robust debate, right? Look at the arguments, philosophical, for and against. Look at the effects of affirmative action policies. Look at the role the courts have played in shaping affirmative action law. But you would approach it with an open mind. But from what we've seen with diversity training, the assumption is that affirmative action is an unmitigated good, and that you can actually see that one of the microaggressions that's on many of these microaggression handouts is the statement something like, I believe the most qualified applicant should get the job. That itself can be seen as a form of a hostile microaggression. So if you could show me that diversity training would significantly affect the campus climate, and you would end up with more diverse students and faculty bodies and a more empathic understanding campus community, sign me up. But as an academic institution, it's our responsibility to ask the question, does this particular intervention achieve the desired result? And the evidence with respect to diversity training is overwhelming, and the answer is no. So there's something particularly galling to Amna and I that universities again and again and again have turned to this box-checking exercise instead of doing that messy, hard, sometimes volatile and certainly uncomfortable work of really grappling with diversity in all its many forms.
These trainings, they have no place on college campuses. They may have a place in a corporate boardroom, but on a college campus, for faculty, I mean, it's deeply insulting. We are in the business of teaching these things, which are incredibly complex, and it's an attack on our expertise when you bring in a consultant who gives you a box-checking list and then says, you know, check the right answer and then you're done. I mean, really, if it was that simple, if dealing with racism was that simple, do you think we'd be here hundreds of years later still grappling with the consequences and trying to find a solution to it? So I think there's something antithetical about these trainings on college campuses because it is very much an attack on the expertise of humanities professors. And we constantly talk about the attack on expertise from the extreme right. And this is an attack on expertise from within the academy that I find fundamentally upsetting.
In our interview with Amna and Jeff, we talked about more than DEI. What is and is not acceptable speech is also a heated topic. All of these questions have grown much more salient and intense since the Hamas attacks of October 7th in Israel and the protests and the conflicts that have flared up on so many campuses. You both wrote about a statement that the American University recently made concerning this. The statement said, quote, "Recent events and incidents on campus have made Jewish students feel unsafe and unwelcome," which is probably true, but you think the policy they connected to that statement is wrong. Why?
Well, the policy they connected to that statement is that they banned all indoor protests. So, of course, college universities have a right to impose some sort of time, place, and manner restrictions. You can't have a demonstration at 3 o'clock in the morning in the library when students are trying to study or hold a vigil in front of the fire exit. The only fire exit outside of your dorm, but to impose a blanket restriction on all indoor protests is a remarkably restrictive place restraint.
You think the American University approach is too heavy-handed. It limits certain kinds of expression on one side too much, and it makes demands on student groups that are unrealistic. What would be a better way to establish a system where students are free to protest, but recognizing you're on a campus where the primary mission is education. And many of these protests I've seen are really designed to disrupt the ordinary workings of a university and to also, I think, in many cases, intimidate certain members of the student body. So how do you set up a system that allows a wide range of free speech, but doesn't tolerate those kind of things that are hurtful to the community in that way?
I'm going to take the part about hurtful. How do we not hurt other members of the community? And I think this again points to one of the kind of grave and detrimental underpinnings of DEI Inc. is that we've somehow taken on this role that we need to reduce harm. You ruffle my feathers and I'm harmed. And if we're going to go with that model, then you're going to have to stop all protest. Well, that's not really fostering diversity and bringing in people from other viewpoints. So the first thing I'd say is, I think we need to move away from this model of harm and move to a model of recognizing that education is about empowerment and emphasize that we are equipping our students with a thicker skin and with the skills that are necessary to navigate a very complex world with many different kinds of people in it.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is highly complex. Where do these passionate protests and slogans fit into the debate over speech and education?
So saying from the river to the sea can mean genocide in one particular context, but it can also not mean genocide in a different context, depending on the background of the student and what the framing of the protest is. So I'd argue the first thing we need to do is to have a better understanding of the conflict, get our students to have a better understanding of the conflict. And we can, as educational institutions, play a phenomenal role over here. So look at Dartmouth. I think Dartmouth has a fantastic model where they're brought together faculty from, I think, one of their Jewish studies programs and one of their Middle Eastern studies program, and they held teach-ins. Moments of conflict provide the ideal situation for faculty to step in, to bring in our expertise, to model for our students, A, how learning happens, and also how disagreement happens in a way that is productive, but doesn't become a shouting match.
If you look at a lot of the public commentary, and especially public criticism of student protests in the wake of the October 7th terrorist attacks, a lot of people will say, listen, the students protesting, the slogans, the marches, this is all distraction from the business of higher education, which is the production and dissemination of knowledge. I think that that point of view is actually profoundly misguided, because for over 100 years, the mission of higher education has had two facets. One is that knowledge production and dissemination. The goal there is to help students develop critical thinking skills. But the second facet is the preparation of students to be informed, engaged citizens. And as part of citizenship, protest is a huge element of what it means to be a citizen in the United States. When people say, well, these protests are so disruptive, damn right they are. That's the whole purpose of a protest, is to disrupt. Now, here's a crucial point. That shouldn't be happening in my classroom or Amna's classroom. Different speech rules, regulations, and norms govern different parts of the campus. But when you're on the quad, at the height of a politically charged moment like this, we can't expect necessarily that civil discourse is going to prevail. People can get in your face and say something that may be offensive. In a classroom, is there a spot for that? No, it's evidence-based. It's grounded in the text. One should be respectful. But the last point I want to make about harm, and I think that this is a crucial one, it's in the eye of the beholder. And so one of the things that I've been fascinated by watching the conflict over the Israel-Hamas war is that a number of pretty smart people have made a fundamental category error. The error is conflating criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism. And so there's a huge debate going on now about whether Israel's approach as a state with respect to Palestinian peoples, the West Bank and Gaza, is a form of apartheid. This is a hugely contentious debate, and there's merit to both sides. But you have a whole host of people, including Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, who has argued that the mere statement that Israel is an apartheid state is a form of anti-Semitism. And this strikes me, well, as intellectually sloppy, but as incredibly dangerous. Because once you make the mistake of conflating criticism of a government policy with criticism of its people, that completely crushes the space, narrows the space for any legitimate political criticism, especially on human rights grounds. You've seen this at many universities across the country, where students of Chinese descent have argued that criticisms of the Chinese government state policies in places like Tibet and Xinjiang are a form of anti-Chinese hate, are a form of racism. To me, that's a dead end, intellectually and from a civic point of view.
You've criticized the progressive left, but both of you have argued in a court brief and elsewhere against the MAGA right, and specifically the Stop Woke Act in Florida. Talk about your objections to that. Amna?
I think people get confused because we seem to have no team. And that is true. We have no team, but we have principles.
Oh, that's where we are. That's where we are.
Good. To my mind, the one thing that is sacred is academic freedom, especially in higher education. I would argue the thing that has made American higher education the envy of the world is precisely that freedom for open inquiry. In the classroom, in your research, in your kind of general atmosphere on campus. What the Stop Woke Act is trying to do is actually limit what you can teach and how you can teach in your classrooms. And this is, again, an ideologically motivated attack on academic freedom. And it runs counter to the very enterprise of education. Jeff and I got involved in this as we wrote an amicus brief in our individual capacities to support the case that is challenging the Stop Woke Act.
So the Stop Woke Act is one of a number of recent attempts to rein in the influence of DEI, but you argue that it also undermines support for free speech.
What the left and the right share, the censorious wings of both sides of the political spectrum share, is a commitment and a strong belief in the discourse of harm. So if you look at one of the key concepts that one cannot even articulate in a Florida public school classroom from kindergarten through college, it's the idea that members of a particular racial group feel any kind of psychological distress for actions committed in the past by members of the same racial group. There's an element of absurdity to that, because that would mean that if I, as a white student, were reading about the history of slavery, an intrinsically horrifying and distressing institution, that I could raise my hand and say, hey, you know what? As a white man, I'm feeling really distressed learning about the history of slavery in the United States and what people who share my racial background have been responsible for perpetrating. That's a lesson for enforced compulsory historical ignorance. But I think it's interesting that both sides have been so willing to latch onto a very psychological, therapeutic model of education in which material can be so distressing, so dangerous, that they simply have to be banned altogether. And that's a commitment, unfortunately, that you see the Ron DeSantis's of the world have in common with many of the people who are associated with DEI Inc.
You mentioned the DEI etiquette and the vocabulary. And a lot of getting a college degree these days boils down to learning the right words for things. You can never say third world. You have to say global south. You know, you have to understand microaggressions. You have to understand the various permutations of LGBTQ and what queer means. And then you are really shamed if you use the wrong word. Do you feel like all of that in some ways is a way of reinforcing social status for people who are already privileged enough to get into these elite institutions?
Amna?
It's a really good question, Jim. And where do most of the complaints come from when I am teaching, for instance? Who are the students who are asking me to cut out material which they think is troubling? And more often than not, it's my white privileged students who come from upper class or, you know, upper middle class backgrounds who are making the case for cutting these things out. And I don't want to doubt their intentions. I think they're you know, it's a good heart. And they're like, well, they're being good allies. But the fact of the matter is that this way of thinking of what we're
doing. Explain, when you say cutting things out, what kinds of things do you mean?
Like readings that, like, for instance, I used to teach a course on women in South Asia, which dealt with sexual violence. And they're very concerned that reading about sexual violence for people who have survived it might be very difficult, or people who have been at the receiving end of racist violence or epithets, you know. So whether we can read those things in class and whether it'll cause damage or harm to those people, instead of treating other students as individuals, they are being reduced to their identities and what is thought to be the right response and the only response for that identity. It's not treating people as individuals who can rise and transcend and be more than their race or more than their gender or more than, you know, whatever identity you want to put in there.
So in conclusion, you're for messiness, you're for curiosity, you're against rigid orthodoxy, you're against making things seem much simpler and therefore less interesting than they really are.
Absolutely.
Sorry. Richard, you've completely hit the nail on the head. The fact that we can have diversity trainings dealing with this wonderful, messy, multifaceted, multi-perspectival thing called diversity in the United States, and you come out of a diversity training bored and possibly upset, that's crazy. These are the richest, most fascinating, complex topics. And that's, I think, what really irks Amna and I. You want to talk about diversity in the United States? Read a James Baldwin novel and have a discussion. That will lead to endlessly fascinating conversation that is so much different from the kind of conversation that's encouraged by a training.
Professors Jeff Snyder and Amna Khalid.
And that was our discussion with Richard Davies and Jim Meggs for How Do We Fix It? Don't forget to rate and share Banished on whichever platform you listen, and do leave a comment so we know what you think. Thanks for listening. This is Banished, and I, as always, am Amna Khalid.